Welcome. This is Why Life Is, and I'm your host, Niles McFlower. And tonight we have another great show dealing with metaphysics and spirituality, some elements of science, and questions about cosmology and the universe in general. And tonight I thought we'd talk about preparing spiritually for death. Now, this may not be as morose a show as you think, because after I define for you what I mean by this, you'll see that it isn't what you think it is, I think, at any rate, or at least what it sounds like. So let me start off by just getting into that that idea. What do we mean by spiritually preparing for, you know, for death? It means that when a person is conscious enough to recognize that not only is death inevitable in their specific circumstances, not just for themselves or for those around them, their loved ones, people they know, etc., but beyond that, beyond the obvious, because that is obvious, that they no longer fear death for anyone. They can regret some elements about it because it does do some things, which is one of those things, is it destroys the awareness of a dimension of time and space that that they were familiar with in one way or another. Now, that awareness could go from themselves, and then they no longer have the awareness of this dimension of time and space in many respects. They might have some element that they can rely upon to sometimes perceive some things in the dimension that they're leaving. But they also lose the awareness of others that are leaving, you see, if it's not about their death. And that's another part of the whole equation, let's say. And all of these things put together, for a lot of people, add up to a element of fear that sometimes is quite irrational and most times has to do with with several issues. One of them is that there is a God that created our universe, and in that creation, God does not destroy consciousness. In other words, God's plan is that consciousness exists forever. Only form, which is energy, changes and becomes something different over certain periods of time related to forces created by the fact that time even exists. So ultimately, that's God's plan. Now, if people understand that, then the fear of death starts to lessen. And if they further understand the following things, that besides consciousness continuing on, the ability to act and react, which is the third part of God's mind, also continues. It does. And even though in some respects some of the actions that are taken dimensionally in a certain part of the universe, like fear, here's an example, physically where we live, those may become changed and to some extent considerably different. But action and interactions with others does not change to the point where you don't have any anymore, ever. You can, for some period of time, in some parts of time and space, lose the ability to interact with some or most other people for a while. But that's some distance away from where we are right now. And so in this situation, the fear that most people have is based upon illusion. Yeah. In other words, illusion is that we don't sense correctly what's really going to happen when we die. And since we don't sense correctly, until we correct our senses about it, we will continue to have an irrational fear about it, no matter how much you turn on the station or whatever and listen to me or others, or listen to or read whatever books or whatever that are out there, or even if you have literally out-of-body experiences, which for most people mitigates a lot of their fear of death, but not completely, because of the things that I'm going to be discussing and what I've already said in the first 5 minutes. So ultimately, when we look at the situation, preparing spiritually for death is really becoming more aware and conscious while you're alive, because that's what does the preparing, so that we have a death that is not one of either ours or anyone else's, not one of great consternation and fear and suffering and misery. That's what I'm hoping that the next couple of hours will bring us to a new level. Now, you can say, oh, well, yeah, it's just a bunch of words. You don't really know. Well, in my particular case, that isn't exactly true for me. But regardless of whether I know, understand, and have firm understanding, we'll say, of what I'm talking about, it doesn't change anything for you all. That's where we've got to work on this. Because no matter what I teach here on the radio or whatever books you might read of mine or whatever, you don't have necessarily a conviction, unless you're a rear person, about the things that I'm going to say that you need to prepare for. Once you are prepared, your life takes on a totally different meaning. And I think you will appreciate this more as we go through the subject. But so this is a real, you know, how-to kind of thing that hopefully will lead us in a direction where for many listeners, I'm not going to say this is going to work for everybody, because there's going to be some folks who just plain don't buy it. And those folks who will cause their own suffering, I can't change that. I can only give you the tools, explain how it all works, and then hopefully you'll try it out. And I think once you do, a lot of this, these issues that are plaguing humanity will be reduced. The less fear people have of death, the more creative they are while they live, the more they are more rational and reasonable, and the less they are selfish and have a lot of, we'll say, a lot of destructive elements to their behaviors for themselves and others. So these are things that I think will definitely have a benefit if we can get through this. All right, so if fear and illusion are really the bottom line about what death is in the, we'll say, connotative sense, that means how most people would define death, not the dictionary way, but I'm saying most people say, well, death is really bad and it's all terrible. So then we need to look at the process and how we can mitigate it all the way up to the moment that we finally leave this dimension of time and space, or others do around us, and then how we can relieve ourselves of most of the misery, suffering, terror that some people have, etc. So let's go through that. First of all, I think the first part of it that I want to get to is just the abject fear. In other words, I'm going to suddenly no longer exist. Now, existence, as I'm going to define it, is going to be as close as I can to what I think people really feel. And that is that they feel that non-existence is the real meaning to them of death. So it isn't like, oh, gee, I stopped breathing, or, oh, gee, I'm going to have some real bad pain in my heart or real bad pain here or there for a few seconds, and then I'm going to be no longer, whatever. But most people have this, we'll say, irrational fear of non-existence. The reason I say it's irrational, it would be very rational if it were true. In other words, if it was true that the second we die, we cease to exist, all consciousness stops, and it's as though we were never here. We're just gone. It's poof. Yeah. For most people who are humanists, some people who are scientists, and almost all people who are atheists, that's a reality. In other words, they have in their consciousness this belief that as soon as they die, they cease to exist. What, in metaphysical terms, what we're really talking about is the death of consciousness. And since in ageless wisdom and many other traditions of spiritual belief, consciousness continues on and never dies, then we are in contradiction with a whole body, we'll say, of spiritual understanding. Some of it is religious, and many religions still follow the same tenet. So ultimately, when we look at this circumstance, the irrational part of death is really about people's illusion about spirituality and religion. Why do I say that? Well, it's basically this. If people weren't illusioned about spirituality and many parts of religion and associated concepts, then they wouldn't have a fear of death, because those teachings say that consciousness doesn't die. And since the bottom line fear of death is the ending of consciousness, I'm talking about the terrorizing fear of death, not the fear of being uncomfortable or going through some kind of painful experience. That is a minor thing. I'm talking about the terrorizing, real terrible fear that people have of death. Okay, so there we have it. It's illusion. You see that? I hope you do. Even if you don't believe that it's true that you have that, you can see how that could be true based upon the logic that I just presented. All right, so then what do you do? I mean, let's face it, I mean, nobody can come and just say, okay, well, it's really like this, because if they could have, you would have already bought into it. And how come so many people say they are very spiritual and say they are very religious, and yet they have this profound bottom-line fear of death? Well, the answer is, again, illusion. It's illusion about themselves. They want to believe. They want to be spiritual. They aspire towards a spiritual and or virtuous even life. But the problem for them is that all the aspiration and desire has not become a real part of their life. And spirituality, you're only as spiritual as you live it. So if you're not living spiritually, then you have the hypocrisy of saying that you're spiritual, but you don't live it. And in not living the spiritual life, you then have the schism that creates the illusion it comes from illusion, may create more of it, of this gross fear of death. All right, so I hope you're following me so far, because, again, this is the highly conceptual part that we always start with that I burn brains out on. And then we get to the more, okay, what are we going to do about all this kind of, give me some answers. That's later. For right now, I'm still trying to define what we're talking about so that everybody is on the same page. Because otherwise, my solutions won't make much sense, because they won't fit. You gotta get to the basis of what the problem is in order to see what the solution is going to do for it. All right, so there's part of it right there. That's a big part. Okay, what about then? This is to a large extent about ourselves on a personal, I'm going to die someday, we're all going to die someday. What about the fear of death of loved ones, be they, humans or pets? Or how does that play out then in this whole scenario? Well, not too differently, except that unlike the loss of our consciousness, we fear the permanent loss of the consciousness of those who die around us. Same thing, but it's not our consciousness. And in these cases, the relevant issue here is the question of permanence, because it certainly is a true statement that in most circumstances, if you have a dear one close to you, no matter who that is, including pets, and they die, their consciousness in most circumstances is removed from our awareness and our interactive consciousness with them. That is, to many people, a very, we'll say, that is not terrorizing as much as it is, we'll say, depressing and of a grave sense of suffering or loss. Okay, so that is a true statement, but the difference is permanence, because in the scope of our life and in the way things turn out, in most circumstances, we're never more than about 50 years from seeing that person again, in most circumstances. So what you really, unless it's a young child, and that could have a longer period, depending upon how long you're going to be alive physically before you go to the astral world. And it is possible with younger children, you can miss them completely. In other words, they could die, and then before you die, they go to the monastic or mental world, and you don't see them again, because by the time you get to the astral world, they're gone. And then even by the time you get to the mental world, they'll be gone too. So the problem there lies in the way time is dilated and the differences in the elements of that circumstance. There are some ways around it, but I don't want to get into those exceptions right now. I just want to talk about the specifics of what people feel. But that's still not a permanent loss, because I'll explain why in a minute. But the biggest issue here is that for a lot of people, if they don't think that your consciousness goes on, then in most cases, the concept that, well, you know, in X number of years, you're going to see those folks again in the astral world. And it's likely true, because people of common consciousness will be found in similar realms that the astral world will be able to be in contact with each other. People of disparate consciousness, where one is relatively low and one is really relatively high, they may not be much contact, if any, unless the one with the higher consciousness chooses to change that to some extent. So they may not, but the odd thing about that is people tend to miss most those who are closest to them in consciousness. They don't specifically very much miss people that are very, very different from themselves in consciousness. They might notice them being gone, but the actual missing part, the suffering part, probably wouldn't be there. All right, so practically, when we look at the situation, most people will meet up with those that are leaving them. Yes, they will miss them for the time that they're physically remaining alive here, and vice versa, those going on to the next dimension of time and space will have very little understanding or knowledge about the people here, but they won't be able to interact on every circumstance. So the results are going to be, again, this separation. Is that a terrible thing? Well, it is to some extent, but I want you to think about this. In our lifetime, how many people are in your life, even if they're children, even if they're spouses, where for the entire lifetime you're going to be in continual contact with that person on a conscious level? Or is it true that even our close families and closer friends at one time or another become more distant? You see, consciousness is not necessarily founded upon just proximity. Sometimes consciousness becomes part of us by having a history of it and an understanding of it for both time and, we'll say, completeness in the past. And for many people, that serves them through their whole life. And so death doesn't have to be that much different. It is more permanent, depending on the circumstances. But it's not that much different than somebody moving to the other side of the world and calling you once a year and saying, hi, how you doing? It really, when you look at it from the standpoint of how we actually live, that is really not as big an issue as we make it. If we hold on to the relevance of having known someone, even if they were an enemy, even if they've done things that we didn't care for, if we see the importance of their consciousness in our life, from however it entered and became interactive with us, that consciousness stays alive within us, within our own consciousness. And so the missing is really a relevant issue to the people who have lack consciousness and then don't hold on to the consciousness that they have with and from other people or other close entities. And the results can then be missing them even more dramatically at the point of death. So obviously, keeping your consciousness and growing it expands the ability, we'll say, to be very close with and to be, we'll say, interactive for all of your life with those who have come and gone for various reasons, including death. So again, expanding consciousness alleviates the experience of negative experiences of death from us in numerous ways. That's right. When people have the worst reactions to the death of loved ones, it's because they oftentimes have a breakdown in their consciousness or had one beforehand, and that can lead to all kinds of emotional problems and other difficulties. This is really fascinating to me because looking at it from the standpoint of psychology, it's a strange kind of way of seeing the world that we are torturing ourselves through lowering consciousness, and we'll get to how we raise it, of course, but through demeaning and destroying the relationships we have with people through our own consciousness, not just through the experiences of the wantonness of death or life in terms of each person. Or it's kind of an interesting way of looking at it. I know it's different from what most people realize, but it gets closer to the reality of what death is. And that's what we're trying to get to today. Okay. So, now that we've covered that part, let's go a little bit even, we'll say, deeper, but not so much trying to make it in some type of great mystery, but to demystify death. How come death exists? Okay, if consciousness goes on forever, why don't we just have the bodies go on forever? We wouldn't have to worry about this goofy thing, right? And then nobody would suffer, and everybody would be feeling better. And how come God created it in such a way? Well, in order for there to be interaction and growth, there has to be death. Let me explain. For a person who is here, who is not fully conscious, which is almost all of us, and who is not, we'll say, without great glamours and, you know, those are fixed desires, without tremendous amounts of maya from lack of understanding because of tremendous illusions in the physical reality, and without greed and avarice and tremendous levels of selfishness in every kind of way that we interact. These things have, as a normative issue in most people's lives, have stolen from us the ability to move on and to improve ourselves in some lifetimes. This is the point if there were no finality to life, the encouragement to improve these things would be diminished tremendously. And another problem would be that there would be no direct connection in our awareness or consciousness between the fact that we were being selfish and we were not growing and we were not becoming closer to our Creator. And so it would be a serious problem if there were no consequences. What are the consequences? Well, the consequences are the loss of and destruction of the body that we're in the most, using the most senses of while our consciousness is focused to it, which in this case is in the physical world. So it's necessary, in a kind of bitter pill necessity, that we suffer as we move further away from our Creator, and we suffer less as we move closer and co-create with our Creator. The end of the logic is that the suffering that ensues as a result of death is what encourages us to live better if we are not conscious enough to supersede that unfortunate and miserable needed outcome. And the Creator God decided that this was a necessity, especially for humans who had the consciousness to become a co-creator with God and to therefore expand life and make the universe more abundant in it and in ways that were more and more like its Creator. That's what God seeks. But at the same time, if there are no consequences for each of us becoming more and more selfish and lacking the co-creation of virtue, the results would be terribly, we'll say, destructive and in the process almost endlessly failing here in this most difficult of all places to exist. So the consequence of death is a necessity to get us to live better and more while the opportunity avails itself. Living forever in a selfish condition is far worse than destroying the material nature or the physicality of this particular body that we're in, and the next one eventually as well, because we would otherwise languish in a virtual, let's say, meaningless existence, and death would, even though we might not have a fear of it, because if we took it out of the context of it being a reality to us, death then would not create the impetus for change as it does at the present time. It allows us to make spiritual commitments that we would be unlikely to choose were it not a reality. However, it's the illusion of death that creates these monstrous negative issues in humans. If we get out of the illusion, two things happen. We grow and become more virtuous. We keep our word on most issues. We live our life in a way that's enlightening in most circumstances. We do many, many great, great things. Yet, at the same time, we lose our fear of death in commensurate amounts to the amount that we live in it as a co-creator with God. Wow. You see that there's an inverse relationship here. And so God created death because, for various reasons, but because in human beings' cases, It's the fear of loss of consciousness, which becomes a tremendous, tremendous momentum to work on becoming more conscious, so that we realize eventually our consciousness will never end. Now, when is that point? When do we reach that point? Most people reach it in the astral world a bit and complete it in the lower mental world. I would like it if all you listening to me tonight and many others would complete that right now, right here, as soon as possible. Why? Because once you become completely convinced that consciousness continues on forever, you'll become a different person. You'll become more like your soul and less like a selfish personality. That is the antithesis, in many ways, of your soul. So this is why I'm hoping that tonight's show will be a kind of bootstrap up. You got to pull yourself up out of this. You can't. Nobody can do this for you. You've got to do it for yourself. And preparing yourself in this way changes your entire life. It makes everything into a completely different perspective. Now, does that mean that you... I don't want you to think that anything I've said so far means the following, that we should all accept death and welcome it as soon as it happens, because, after all, there's nothing to be afraid of. So let's all go jump off a building or go do something terrible to ourselves, because it doesn't matter. No, it matters enormously, because you're becoming unafraid of death so that you can live life more meaningfully and more as a co-creator with God. Not so you can say, gee, I'm not afraid of death anymore, ha, ha, ha. That isn't the purpose at all. So don't get confused about that, because what I'm saying, there's a lot of things I'm saying that could be twisted or turned to a point where a person might completely misunderstand what I'm saying. Because we are an illusion, let's face it, many, many of us are an illusion. Okay, so if everything I've said kind of is gelling, you know, like, hey, it's really coming together, you know, that makes sense, then where does that leave us in terms of our present life? Well, the first element of it is to get perspective. So let me give you some of that. The hardest place to create more of God is where we are right now, the physical world. The shortest time we spend in any one part of the dimensional aspects of the universe that human beings have any awareness of is right here. How long is that? Well, let's say 100 years is how long everybody lived. It's nothing compared to the astral world, where people live way over 500 years of time in some circumstances. That's a long time. And that's not like the super longest of them, but it's certainly possible for someone to live 500 years. Why is that? Well, you could live, say, 30 to 50 years of our physical time here, but the time is dialing. Depending upon what part of the astral world you're in, 15 times is nothing for the time to be dialing. And many people live in 15 times the time dialing. So 15 times 50 would be 750 years a person could live, and that would be the fourth subworld, where the plurality of people actually live. So a lot of people live there. And it's a big place compared to other parts of the rest of the world. And so when we're talking about perspective, we might live 7.5 times longer in the astral world, or 7 times, whatever you want to. Than in the physical world? Yeah, that's about right. That's a huge amount of time. Now, why don't people get bored? Why don't they lose interest in living? I mean, after all, it seems like a long time, right? Well, the time goes up as the people become more creative. So there's a parity between amount of additional time people have to have and what they're doing in that time in terms of co-creation with God and creation in general. And so you have more creative worlds that people live in where they have much more time to be creative in. And to them, it's just a natural kind of rhythm, not too different than when they were physically alive, but with vast amounts of more, we'll say, cogent understanding of what is happening around them. And at the same time, they recognize that where they're existing is more virtuous on average. They actually have more capability to be creative. And they have more sense. They have more sense automatically because there's another dimension of time and space to each one of their senses, which grows their senses exponentially in terms of what they can and can't do with their senses and bodies, and specifically the astral body. And they live in a totally, we'll say, more immersed kind of world, where to their perspective, no, they don't get bored. They get interested. They get invigorated. They get creative. They maybe have more intense relationships than they ever had while they were physically alive. And the relationship with God is specifically greater. One of the things that's so great is that at least they've gone through one body change, and they know that their consciousness did not die because they're still alive somewhere else. And that in itself is a relief because they know it's going to happen again and they're going to go to the lower monastic world. It kind of changes everything. It allows people to, through their perspective, recognize that their consciousness, instead of fading away into nothingness, became greater, wider, because their senses improved. They have a new body when they get over there that is barely aged and is doing terrific. And they're young again, even in the way they project their own appearance, which they're in control. They're also far more in control of existence within themselves and others than they ever were while they were physically alive, where forces were so great that no matter how hard they tried, some things they just couldn't achieve because the world around them was relatively dark and difficult. But that's on average. Not everybody has that experience because some people are so very selfish, they don't let themselves experience that. Instead, they experience more negative and hostile elements to life. Regardless, on an average, people are more conscious, and the astral world is actually a higher consciousness world than the physical one. Now, you could say, well, I read some things, and I don't know how that's true or whatever. And, well, it's not exactly true in 100% of the time, but on an average, it is. So that's what we're doing with the averages. All right. So I hope this is making some sense to y'all. And we're getting to the point now where we're seeing that death is not what we ever thought it to be. And preparing spiritually for death is really a very good idea. When we come back, I'll tell you some of the things that you can be doing more directly in preparing spiritually for death. And the emphasis of the rest of the show will be more in that direction, with less of this, very hardcore conceptual talk. I'll maybe throw a little bit more at you. But okay. So we will be back in 2 minutes and 30 seconds from right now.
Hun, what book are you reading?
It's a novel, kind of, about romance, love, and spiritual life in general.
Kind of a novel? What do you mean?
Well, it's based on some real-life experiences and even real characters. Some of their experiences are fascinating and remarkable. I can't put this book down.
How come the title is Afterlife Love?
That's part of the fascination. This book describes the afterlife in intricate detail and even explains why things are the way they're explained.
But how can anyone write about or know that?
Some of the characters travel out of body to some places that people who've already died also go to. I'm finding it completely believable because it all makes sense and fits into a bigger picture for me.
Hun, what happens to these people?
You can read it for yourself when I'm done if you want.
Better yet, I'll get my own copy so we can discuss it while we read. Let me see. I'll write down the title. It's Afterlife Love by Niles McFlower, MacFlower.
Afterlife Love is available in some bookstores and from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com or 480-966-3132. That's 480-966-3132.
Hi, everyone. Since childhood, I've had questions about my life and life in general that I couldn't find adequate answers to. Questions like, why am I here? Why are others here? Does the universe have a purpose? And how does that relate to my life? More recently, I've been wondering what happens when we die, especially the reasons why. I'm more of a doubter than a believer in many things, and answers that include the whys allow me to think and figure out the truth for myself. I've been reading a book, Life's Hidden Meaning. This one book contains more answers, including the whys, than all other sources I've read or heard. It's amazing to me that every one of my questions has been thoroughly answered. More importantly, I have found that all of these answers so far have checked out to be true. I hope this message helps some of you in your quest for better understanding. The name of this wonderful book is, again, Life's Hidden Meaning by metaphysician Niles McFlower. Some bookstores sell it. I got my copy directly from the publisher at agelesswisdom.com. Life's Hidden Meaning may enlighten your mind and bring some peace and joy to your heart.
We're back. This is Why Life Is, and I'm your host, Niles McFlower. Tonight we're talking about preparing spiritually for death. If you've heard the first part of the show, you know it's not that morose idea that many people might construe about this subject. And we're going to talk about practical issues that can be done to improve our perspective about the death of ourselves and those around us. And in addition to that element, we're also going to deal with some of the, we'll say, more obscure ideas that still play into understanding this subject. So let's start with children, because I think this is possibly the most difficult area for most people to deal with. How do you deal with your kids to deal with the death of those around them, including maybe little friends they might have for some strange reason they die, and then maybe animals, of course, do die, and usually children go through some experience with that. And then you have eventually death of parents, grandparents, great-grandparents, if they're still alive, and people around them, maybe a teacher, maybe someone else. These things happen. They're going to happen. So, and then sometimes a child has a life-threatening illness or somebody they know, right, or something like that. Besides the obvious possibility of a car accident or any kind of accident killing people. So, how do you deal with these questions? And then the first thing I want to emphasize here is that, and I know some of you may be in this category, if you are strongly an atheist, you're going to have a very hard time dealing with this. Because the bottom line on death is that God created the universe. God created life, and therefore God created death. If you eliminate God from the picture and you say the universe created itself, life is some fictitious element that just accidentally pops in, and death is equally as quismatic and crazy because it doesn't have any relationship to anything and no meaning in it. Well, a meaningless activity that seems to remove very important elements from people's existence becomes, to most people, terrorizing in itself. This is the first part of death that we learn when we're children, because we can't grasp the subject very well, and most people don't try to help us. So the results are that death becomes this almost vague but terrifying concept that we learn early in life to repress. Now, you might say, well, what's so wrong with that? And, well, my kids won't think about that so much, and that'd be a good thing. It's actually a very bad thing, because it develops a kind of subclinical depression in all of us, most of us, I should say. Most children actually get a little depression about death, and then every time someone or something incorporates the element of death, it becomes even worse for them. So So what do they do to try to inoculate themselves against this? Well, if you're not going to bring God into the equation, and or any spiritual and or religious belief structure, then you're going to end up with the following weird syndrome. And that is that to alleviate death, children role-play death all the time. And they watch it, and they love it, and they become addicted to that because it's a way of relieving the anxiety by conditioning themselves to something that is arbitrary and false, but that they may unfortunately believe, and therefore it's a very pathological kind of adjustment that some parts of our society have taken onto itself that is screwing up our kids. And the answer is God. But if you don't like that answer, then some of the things that I'm going to say, at least in this part of the show, are not going to necessarily fit very well for you. Here's the point. God is necessary to alleviate most of the aberrant understanding that children gain about almost everything, especially death. And beyond that, once children grasp some of the non-illusioned ideas, if I'm right, so we'll put that in there, coming from religions and spiritual understandings, including ancient wisdom, then they stop being fixated on role-playing and playing in death. And their emphasis in their playing is more on life issues. I know this because I've observed this in children. When I was in practice as a psychotherapist, it was so obvious that that was the case, that it actually had an important effect on changing my attitude about God. So this is important. Your children come first, even if you can't quite swallow or believe in the theories of these spiritual positions that God exists and is the creator in the universe, for the sake of your children, it might be worthwhile to present it to them as a possible outcome and let them come to their own realization about it without contaminating it with your prejudices and beliefs outside of that, because you're going to be harming the kids. Just from that one issue, and there's a lot of other issues why it's important for children to learn virtue and understand God. So it's not just this one thing, but it's certainly a biggie. Okay. So children have a lot of fears about death. Some children, without spiritual foundation in their life, have greater amounts than others. So what do you do? The first thing is to boost the amount of spiritual learning that they have at a young age. Bring up God as one of the first things to bring up, not the last thing, as many people do. And allow children to ask questions and give them real answers. Don't make up silly things. And talk about the areas where children have the greatest fears, because that's where you can do the most good. And we know that if they have illusions, which they're going to have, about death, then it's good to maybe talk about some of the elements of the show. I'm not suggesting that you play the show for young children, but I am suggesting that you take some of the things from it and you re-educate, re-teach them in your own vernacular, your own ways of putting it to them. That's a very good way to function. You can use the show as like a springboard, a little bit of extra help. Use some of the knowledge that I'm talking about and a composure own way of telling your kids about this or other kids about it. What else is the issue here? Well, children also have a misunderstanding about what death is because it seems so distant to their sense of reality. Because for them, in the amount of time that they have already lived, if they're 3, 5, 10 years old, it's a very small number compared to where they're, what they're going to live. So each year it moves more slowly. We all see this when we're young, and faster as we get older. And to them, it seems like such a long time that they can't put it in perspective for their reality, because they believe, as many people do, that they're going to live the average number of years or longer that people live, which today is like 75 years old, right? Okay, so they don't equate that as the same kind of perspective that an adult would. This also causes more denial of the concept of death. And what are they really denying is the fact that, although averages do apply to some extent, people can die at any age. And they're going to find this out slowly as they grow up. It's better that they have a better, the wider grasp on death, the understanding in a spiritual sense of what its meaning is. And that all the things that they may dread or be concerned about are not as serious an element as they think. The most important is that consciousness exists forever. And consciousness is another word for love. A lot of you know that, of course. And so, it's part of the whole concept of, well, called inclusiveness, love, planning, understanding. These are words that apply to this whole second part of our creator's mind. And it's half of spirit. So this is a big deal. Now, does that mean that you're going to have these huge philosophical, rantings with the kids going over intricate metaphysical questions with 5-year-olds or something? No, of course not. You need to meet them at their level and the questions and concerns they have at their level. Their level might be, what kinds of things will I be doing if I die 3 years from now? Or a friend of mine does, or something like that. Where are they going to go? Will they still be a child? Will they still be able to play? Will they still go to school? Would they have different parents? Obviously, they most likely would, but not necessarily. Some children die at the same moment of their parents. They go to the astral world together. But most don't. Most children don't die when they're young, and most parents don't die with their children, but anything's possible, you see. So when you get into these questions, you talk about them as a kind of a possibility. Maybe not a very high one, but you talk about it as a possibility. These possibilities then expand the child's overall understanding or consciousness, and then the child becomes less fearful and illusioned about that. And the need to repress and to psychodrama death away through various games and things and watching horrible movies, in my opinion, but stuff like that, those kinds of things become less of an attraction to a child who understands death. It's so weird, isn't it? It really is. The other thing that will happen is children gain an appreciation for life. A much greater one in proportion to adults who gain some consciousness about that and use it to change their fears about that. So ultimately, the more you put into this particular subject with younger children, the greater the proportion of increasing consciousness you get out of it, and the faster the reduction in relative terms do they lose of fear of death. And you can say, well, I want my kids to be afraid of death so they don't go running out in traffic and get killed and stuff. No, that's silly. You don't need to be afraid of death not to go play in traffic. You'd be afraid of getting hit by a car, which would be a miserable thing whether you died or not. As a matter of fact, it might be worse if you didn't die in some circumstances. So you could have fear of dangerous behaviors because the behavior itself produces a great deal of pain, suffering, and reduction in capabilities, regardless of what you're dying of. The fear of death itself is a totally different concept. And we mix those up and use these metaphors to try to convince ourselves we don't have to discuss or think about death. No, just the opposite. Children that are prepared spiritually for death are the most conscious of children. And they become very, very conscious human beings as adults. And then they use that in very creative ways. So it increases their creativity tremendously to not have these kinds of fears holding them back. Wow. Remember, a sign that your children are repressing death is an overall reaction to death by wanting to play more and do more things, watch more things that involves death. Okay, so, and how much is that happening these days? It's all over the place. And that's what frightens me so much. I'm frightened of what the destruction of people's concepts about life and death are, and making more and more illusions so that their fears of death are just so inordinate that they have aberrant responses all over the place. And that's definitely true. Now let's go a little bit older. As children become more involved in adolescence, they not only have the early childhood experiences of the distant deaths and the kind of, we'll call it, basic fears that are related to it, but they gain secondary elements of the fears. And these secondary elements are considerably different than you find maybe 5 or 10 years earlier. Secondary elements about death have to do with the excitement of getting closer to death and the callousness of no longer being in reverence of life. Now, you could say, oh, well, that's just a phase people go through when they're teenagers. Well, not all teenagers go through this phase. This is the outgrowth of a kind of overabundant society, like here in the United States and other first world countries, where you see that too much materiality breeds this into people. And it produces these kind of weird effects. And we don't understand where they come from, but I'm trying to explain where they do. So how do you get teenagers to be more reverent of life and less fearful of death with a better understanding of it, and who aren't about to commit suicide or aren't about to challenge their life in silly and preposterous ways that may kill them or severely harm them because they have repressed their true fears about death, which if they didn't have the fears, they wouldn't need to repress them. They wouldn't have such bizarre behaviors as acting out signs. So in the young children, it becomes more a model of internal conflict, and in teenagers, they externalize the conflict of behaviors. And it becomes a very active thing and a very emotional one at the same time. This is a big problem, and you shouldn't discount it. Most people don't understand teenagers because they don't realize the underlying causes of many of their behaviors, which are aberrant. Okay, so teenagers need to be prepared spiritually for that. How do you do that? Well, it's a little different than when you're dealing with just younger people, because teenagers need to be exposed to the realms of God in an experiential sense. How do you get exposed to the realms of God? Because they have a lack of reverence for what God is and therefore what death is and so many other things. Well, one of the ways you do that is by getting them to serve, getting them to volunteer in service, getting them to become beyond volunteering, true servants of spiritual ways. And they need to take a lot of action because most of their problems have to do with interaction and action in ways that are aberrant, particularly in their concerns subconsciously about that. How does it get them to be closer? Because the meaning of their lives start to go up more. Especially if we're talking about true teenagers now, 13 through 19. The meaning of their lives goes up considerably more by their participating in the creation of various virtues. And it needs to be both explained to them, but then shown to them by actually getting them to do it, by participating with close adults, people that they respect and that they want to spend time with together, etc. That's what we need to do with our teenagers if we're going to prepare them spiritually for that. And then get them to realize the aberrant nature of their disregard about death in various ways, and get them to appreciate the value of life by helping people who may be struggling to stay alive or may have issues in that territory, by dealing with people who are dying. That's a bitter pill. Maybe visit hospices. Maybe become, in some ways, a server within that environment. There's many things that can be done here, but they usually involve some activity besides just an understanding and a teaching sense. Again, because this is the nature of the human at this age. They need the interaction. Now, providing that interaction with more of people of their own age is a good thing. So it's usually better to have several teenagers doing this together than just one lone one, maybe with a bunch of older people. It's not as effective if you do it that way. They need to share the experience so they can share their interactions and reactions to how the experience has changed them. This is true of everybody, but it's particularly true of teenagers. They function better as a group because their consciousness is tenuous in so many different ways and continually challenged and changing. What they believe today may not be what they believe next week, truly. And so you've got to allow this to take place, but they need usually camaraderie and others in or around their similar age group, so that they can use this to prepare themselves. Now, is it okay that the teenagers experience people dying? Sure, it is okay. It needs to be balanced with the understanding that consciousness doesn't die, though. It's just the physical form is moving away from this dimension of time and space and is becoming actually not part of the human being anymore. It just becomes a bunch of minerals that are being used in the mineral kingdom. And we become food for others in some strange ways. But the thing that is most important is that consciousness, the teenager knowing that consciousness goes on, is a liberation. And then interacting with others with that perspective in mind frees them and frees the others. So it's a big deal. This is no small thing. And if we can get through that, it's a biggie. It's a tremendous, really big thing. So hopefully this makes some sense to you. If you have teenagers, you know some of the things I'm telling you are true because this is the way they function. I mean, so you can use who they are and what they are to help them to become something much greater by preparing spiritually for that. You don't have to use these words. You don't even have to even tell them specifically what you're doing, although I would be a little bit honest. Because it has such a profound undertone, some of them might get afraid of it, maybe. You know, you can, people who are already afraid of death, if you push the wrong button, you can get some definitely aberrant responses about this subject in comparison to most others, especially. All right. So, When we enter young adulthood, young adults lead their lives in dealing with the illusions of death by excessive materialism. Now, what does that mean? Well, materialism includes sexuality for physical reasons mostly. It involves the gaining and garnering of material things for what most people consider reasons of procurement and satisfaction of owning things, at the same time using some of those things for elements of excitement and fun and pleasure, and sometimes camaraderie. And then, of the basic needs of life are also inclusive within this food, shelter, clothing, etc. So to the younger adult, and especially before age 28, this is the way that they live in illusion about death, because basically those things take such a high precedent over any concern about dying. Again, it's a denial issue that it seldom becomes part of their reality unless they are faced with it in a more direct fashion with someone dying around them or they themselves facing it for various reasons. Now, the point here is to relieve this. The person needs to relieve some of their excessive materialism. Not so easy to do, by the way, because the personality, who's usually in control, the subconscious part of us, seeks to have as much material things as possible, and usually more than we need. And oftentimes, for the very wrong motives, that leads to many, we'll say, selfish behaviors. Okay, how do you deal with that? Well, if you're in that group, the first thing you can do is to relieve yourself of the desires, especially glamorous, the fixed desires, of having more and more things, and try to balance your life. That doesn't mean give away and get rid of, burn everything. No, it doesn't mean that. It means to use the things you have to be of greater service to others and to not, in the future sense, seek to have more and more things in an out-of-balance fashion with having more and more spirit and spiritual meaning in your life. If you balance that part, you don't have to get rid of things. You just need to be spending most of your time and energy on developing a spiritual part, a core of who you are. This changes the young adult into a potentially spiritually mature person by age 28. If they do the things that I'm suggesting, they would also possibly work on picturing their own death from this particular age standpoint on. Now, what does that mean? It means that they are challenging their illusion. I don't want people to become more afraid of death by doing this. I want the opposite to take place. But in order to do that opposite, you've got to challenge the illusion itself. So I found in my own life, and some others, I suggest to try this. And you can do this in a group of people if you're too afraid to do it alone, because most people actually are. You can imagine all the different ways that you might end up dying, which could be next week, next year, and you can pick different time zones, because in the future, we don't know when that's going to happen. You say, okay, I'm going to die in 6 months. Next scenario, I'm going to die in a year. Next scenario, I'm going to die in 5 years. I'm going to die in 10 years. So you give out all these different scenarios, and you live through them to see how that would impact you, how would it affect others, and what that really means in terms of what is going to happen in your existence. When you go through each one of these time-related, I'll call them fantasies, about what your existence would be like going through various kinds of death, and you can pick a whole array of different ones to compound the complexity of the issue. Each one will have a different meaning, because the reason there are so many different ways to die is because, in an odd way, it's a creative process. It is not a single event, as many people think of it. It's actually a almost unique event to each individual who goes through it. And this is where it really helps to do this exercise, because you become more and more creative as you do it. You become less and less afraid of death. And especially if you take it to the next dimension of time and space and you've read some material on it and you have some better understanding how things are there, you then have a fearlessness about the entire process with an appreciation for life itself and for death itself, with none of the normal or abnormal responses that people have from all the illusions that they contain in their life. So this is a very beneficial way of treating this most, we'll say, problematic period in the life of adults. The problematic period can extend not just to age 28, but that's about the earliest you usually see a person becoming more spiritual. It can go all the way up into the 40s. And that's where the problems really get nasty. But I'm going to give you a little breather right now, just for a few minutes, talk about a couple of things, and then we'll come back to why it gets more dicey as we move on with our illusions about death. Well, enough about death for right now. Let's talk about life and leading life in a less painful way. If you haven't heard, Fai Chi Jizik is on sale, and you can get it for a lot less money. A single bottle, large bottle, is now $30, which is great because you can use more of it, get good results. Someone I know just started using it a little over a week ago, and he had pain for 20 years, constant pain, every day, barely could move, a lot of injuries and other things. I won't go into the details. And his pain level, as he put it, was like an 8.5 all the time. I don't know what an 8.5 all the time is. That's a lot of pain. You know, if childbirth is up to the 9 and 10 range in cancers, advanced cancers, and, you know, then I'm not sure where we put 8.5 all the time. But anyway, I suggested he use Jizik in an aggressive, fairly a large dose way. And the results were remarkable. I mean, within a few days, the pain level went down to a 4, a 3, a 2, a 1. Now it's at 1 or less all the time, and he's starting to reduce the amount he's taking. And so this is great. This is great. I mean, a great outcome to talk about. I suggested this very outcome. I didn't know for sure. You never do. Because Jizik works best in people who lead a fairly healthy life. If you're addicted to a lot of things, and you got a lot of other, kinds of, we'll say, habit problems in your life, including maybe using drugs, including alcohol, or even just addicted to eating a lot of food, it could be a problem for you. Jizik may not work as well. It will work over time, but it won't work as well. You may have to use more for longer periods of time to get some of the results. But I just want to caution people about that. Because it's not a panacea, and it only works on most people who live pretty healthy lives, but not even all of them. Okay, so if you want to get some Jizik, you can get it at 602-431-5762, 5-T-Jizik. And you can also go to the website, buyjizik.com. It's all one word, buyjizik, buyjesic.com. Yeah. It's called Fai Chi Jizik. And generally speaking, you take a lot in the beginning and for the first couple or few days, and then you just reduce it if you have some kind of more chronic pain issue. Short term, you can just take a lot, and it just goes away and then come back. But that's depending upon how you want to use it. There's different ways to do it. Okay, so I hope that has made some important, helpful news for people. Again, it's $30. And if you want to get the small bottle of Jizik, that's only $12, used to be 20. And the big bottle used to be 50. So 50 to 30 and 20 to 12. That's a pretty good reduction. And if it doesn't work for you, all you got to do is let us know, get your money back. So this is like a no gamble situation. That's a really good thing. All right, now, preparing spiritually for death. This is where it gets dicey. Most people, not everybody, but most people, go past the age of 28, which is where you're supposed to be developing yourself for spiritual development. The senses will switch over from it them being focused more on material development to spiritual development. But if you're not doing that, you're going to become more and more illusioned and fearful of death. So the people who don't, and that's the majority of people, become more illusioned and fearful of death as they progressively get older. Between 28 and 35, between 35 and 42, those 14 years of time, many people lose a great deal of perspective on their life, and they fall into a depressive element of existence. May feel, in terms of their inner feelings, as though their life is lacking meaning, and it actually may be. I don't want to play down that potential, because it is real. Why is their life losing potential? Because they don't have a balance of spiritual existence. They should be living at least 50% of their life in a spiritual way in comparison to the amount that they live materially. This is not an easy thing to do. Let me explain why. At 28 years old, most people have developed a meager material existence. They have just gotten the tools to become productive in a personal sense in their employment or in their occupation. That's about the time when they start getting proficient, when they can actually earn a lot more money and do a lot more things. In addition, in terms of their relationships with other people, it's the time when they start, if they haven't already, think more about having children, and if they're married, and think more about getting married if they're not, and think more about having deeper relationships if they haven't been doing much of that. All those things happen right around that age. Those kinds of changes can lead to either a more spiritual person, which is a good thing, or they can become fixated on only the material issues. If they get too fixated on the material issues, this is when they start feeling a loss of meaning in life. So someone, let's say, has gotten good at doing their job, they have more skills, they are earning more money. This is what is called spiritual adulthood, not 21, which some people identify as like personal adulthood. But spiritual adulthood really changes the emphasis. And so if you don't hear the calling and you don't respond to it, if you do, the results could be pretty nasty, because then for the next 7 to 14 years, the person loses meaning rather than gains meaning in life. How can they do that? Well, they realize they can become more successful in material sense. That's exactly where they put most of their time and energy. Or they realize they can be more successful in some form of relationships with members of the opposite sex and with people that are friends of the same sex. They may take advantage of this, but only in a material sense. Then their relationships become more shallow, but more successful in the material side. And what the material side of a personal relationship isn't about money, although there might be some relationship in terms of money. It's really about success in holding and establishing the time and energy of other people. And if it's about one person, about that specific person. So you get far better at having and holding and interacting, exchanging time and energy with other people. But if it's just about the time and energy and not about spirit or spiritual existence between you and the others, then the meaning gets sucked out of it. So the weird thing about it is you can say at 35, some people have been highly successful having relationships with friends and maybe a family, having a family, a wife or a husband. But at the same time, the weird thing about it is they may have a hollowness. They may be lacking the spiritual side. What does this do then to their preparing spiritually for death? Well, they actually become more and more unprepared, more and more greatly illusioned because they've been living their life so materially. They don't see what the benefits are, what death is about. They don't get anything about death in terms, because there's no spiritual connection to them. Death is an event. Death is an absolute. Death is feared. Death is in every way, people will try to prevent in some aspects by encouraging the furtherance of the development of the physical body in some cases. But these things do not prevent the overall loss of meaning by the misappropriate way of dealing with death and many other things, too. But they're not living their spiritual life and being as virtuous as they could. All right, so this becomes a big deal. And certainly by 42, it could be huge if a person's made a lot of mistakes in this venue. So then, what do you do? How do you get out of it? Well, unlike the young adult, who really has to do some minor balancing in some respects in this situation, the mid-aged adult has to take a look at this from a totally different perspective. They've gotten much better in their interactions with people. They've learned the skills. Those skills now need to be brought into play, including with their children and their family and everybody, neighbors, everybody, to enhance their spiritual life with those people and to recognize that there is no loss of consciousness at death. There's an increase in consciousness for death. That's kind of a new idea. I didn't say that at the beginning of the show, but that's true. So there's a grace effect from God. Now, how do you get this belief? I mean, if you don't hear me on the radio, talk about it. Well, because you realize it when you overcome the conflicts of the illusion between the ages of 28 and 42. I don't have time to get into all those things because they're intricate, but you actually, life itself is there to help us, and God is there too. Okay, so the point is that at this level now, at this point in people's existence, they're struggling to find meaning in their life, and it's right in front of their nose. It comes from a different relationship with their spouse, their children, their neighbors, their friends, their other relatives, the people they co-work with, the people they co-create with. Everybody they experience becomes maybe a member of the church, maybe a member of some other organization or whatever. Everything comes into play here. And remember, their skill levels are way up. They just haven't been applying them in the right ways. They need to challenge at a much higher level than the younger adult their illusions. Many of them will have to make great sacrifices for the benefit of not just the others that they're sacrificing for, but for themselves, to gain the much higher levels of consciousness necessary to overcome the much greater levels of illusion and fear that have developed through a lifetime, particularly by the 40s, that a person has lived, not properly preparing for spiritually for death. It's true. There you go. What can you do in specific terms? Well, I like the idea of what I said earlier about going through your death, etc. But now, if you're going to really prepare spiritually for death, you've got to look at how you're going to share all this and bring it into the lives of all the people around you, instead of dealing with it as a young adult might, more from a centrally focused aspect. Because they're pretty selfish. They're more selfish, actually, in that respect, because they're still trying to develop the material element of personality in themselves. Once they reach the age of 28, it's not that imperative. They may continue to do so falsely, but at least it's not as imperative. So now you have someone, say, who's 35 years old, and they maybe have a couple kids, and they have a pretty meaningful relationship, they think, with their spouse. They go out and do things together. They share other kinds of activities. Maybe they go to church and spend a few hours talking to other members of the church together about certain limited spiritual meanings. But what they don't do is they don't figure out how they can co-serve together to develop themselves spiritually more and how to relieve the fears and illusions that other people have besides just themselves about that. And they do this should be done in exercise. energizes, that brings the whole concept together of limitation of life by just the number of years we live into the equation of any activity that they choose to do, without being forced to do it because they've gotten into the next group of older people that do it by force rather than by election. It's better to do it by election because then you can be far more creative. And then when you, as you grow older, you're not pushed into it by your body's failing and by the world around you becoming less and less flexible and you not having the adaptability to it because the people and yourself that are involved in it have become too rigid. That's the next step, but we'll get there in a minute. Now, so here we have the beginnings, I would call it, of a kind of rebirth. You've heard people say they're going through midlife crisis. Sometimes it's moving back in time, trying to reestablish who a person really is in a spiritual sense. That happens during these crises and these time periods. Not uncommon at all. Sometimes if it's not done and shared with others, then the others become conflicts in the struggle that each is having. And that's what breaks up relationships, marriages, families, and partnerships and work and partnerships and other elements of society. So it ultimately becomes either the albatross around your neck, or it becomes the, we'll say, incitement of creativity. And that's usually one or the other to listen to. If you're having the first, the more difficult one, realize it's because you're not bringing others, that you are capable of doing so, into part of your spiritual life. And by not doing that, they're becoming more and more separated from you, and the distance that creates, and because they have the same kinds of fears and illusions, they're just moving and spinning away from you instead of you working in a common issue together. So preparing for spiritual death at this age, at these ages, again, 28 to about 42, provides us with a whole new scope. This is the time when many people can correct, and often do, some of the mistakes that they have been making, and not being spiritual enough in their balance of life. Some people openly talk about it, that they really like to do this, but for this reason or that reason, they may still be fearful. All the fear that they have comes from their fear of death, or 99% of it. Believe me, it's weird. It's so repressed in us. If you read Life's Hidden Meaning, I say most fear is death. It's the fear of death. It's just another disguise that we put on it at different ages and times in our life. And it screws us up pretty royally. It really does. Okay, so let's move on, because otherwise we won't really get to the completion of this whole concept that I'm trying to build up here. What about people who go beyond this particular juncture? Many people do. And again, we'll take it to about age 49. It's about another period of time where people start to, either they've been successful by about 42, and they really start restructuring their relationships with others and being more spiritually involved with them and more co-serving together. And in revealing their deeper elements of fearing death together so that they now have a foundation about who they really are and where they're really going. That changes everything. If all the people, imagine this, if all the people around you had that perspective about death, when people died or were facing death, what would their reality be like if they and everybody else had that perspective? It would be a whole different ballgame, wouldn't it? A whole different one. And so fear is a big issue. The more we're afraid, the more selfish we are. Humans. But animals are to some extent, too. So fear is a huge problem. Now, when we get to 49 or so, in that 49-50 range. Most people, if they have not dealt with these issues, have, like, a total meltdown. And the meltdown usually results in an acceleration of the degeneration of their physical system. It even genetically shows that the speed at which we genetically decline happens much more rapidly. It may take another 10 years before you realize it, like at 60 years old. But it nonetheless goes on this way. And it's a very, very strange thing. Now, in spiritual terms, what's happening is the first phase of your life ends at 49. What is that phase? It goes through seven different ways that we develop ourselves, which, again, I'm not going to go through today. If you want to, you can look at my meeting, or you can listen to some other shows I've done on this. But you've gone through seven distinct phases of life that deals with elements of God. That's the best way to understand it. How well you discovered God and you co-created with God in each one of those seven-year periods tells you where you're going to end up at the end of the 7 years. Some people have so many conflicts, they actually subconsciously kill themselves. Really. Especially people with a lot of fourth-rate kind of, they have a fourth-rate personality, maybe another fourth-rate body in them. They're very selfish in some ways. They could end up with really doing crazy things that eventually kills them. Sometimes the behaviors they don't think are going to kill them, but the point is they're still very dangerous, and they may do so anyway. Another property that takes place is that internally, what we think, energy follows thought greater than its own. So what we think about ourselves has a tremendous effect on our internal development and aging factors. So people start aging more quickly after 50 than they did before 50, although all the signs and effects of it may not be fully realized for another 10 years, but the point is it's happening inside of them. If they're very selfish and they're fearful and illusioned, kind of all goes together. And they haven't obviously adequately prepared themselves spiritually for that. So to them, this whole thing becomes maybe a both advocation and almost a desperation of preventing the over time the aging process and seeking a material solution for death. I mean, they may go pay someone in, you know, Scottsdale to freeze them if they die at any time when they could be frozen, because maybe they can be brought back to life a century from now, shades of Woody Allen. But the problem with that is that there would be no meaningful element to doing it. Not that it couldn't be done someday. The question is, why do it? You see, they've lost their perspective so far that they think that death is the end of consciousness. Well, then, when they bring them back to life, their consciousness comes back, and it's just like they were never really dead. They just had a long sleep in a cryogenic 300-degree below zero nitrogen-filled tank for a century or so, or whenever they can be brought back safely. Safely meaning so they would still be alive. Remember, they died of something, so they would have to be able to cure whatever they died of at the same time. All right. At any rate, these kinds of things become the fixation of people in this illusion category. How do you get out of it? Well, instead of looking for, you know, some kind of stainless steel tank at 300 degrees below zero to abide your time, think about the astral world and life after death. Because this is the age when you should be doing that. Not because you're going to die necessarily in the next few years or anything like that, but because it frees you from the lack of creativity that you've had up to that point in living life here. most people find that the spiritual development is consistently needing more and more creation. At the very time when their physical bodies might be slowing down and even getting more disease, they have to become more creative, not less, to resolve this problem if they haven't already. They may have done so a pretty good job, maybe back in their 20s or 30s or 40s. But if they haven't, then they've got to become really creative. And when I say really creative, I'm not talking about for their own sake. The creations that now we have to have benefits mostly, not even 50-50, mostly for others. This is a whole different perspective because it's like a personality. It's reversing roles somewhat forcibly with the self. The self now is going to be in charge of the people who succeed with this. And that's the best way to do it, is to recognize the development of your higher self with your lower self together will succeed in getting a person prepared for death past the age of 50. It's a good time for some people, and it has a lot of elements in it that if you use them correctly, you don't have to lose your family, friends, or anybody else. You don't have to change anything about anything. You just need to change you on the inside and get you to be much less afraid, virtually no fear, by the time you reach 56, say, and certainly by the time you go on and reach 63. This is the most important time to determine whether probably you're going to live for another 40 years or another 4 or 5. It's strange, but you make a lot of mistakes during this time period. You probably aren't going to even meet the average of life expectancy because there's so many things going against you in terms of wrong thinking, wrong actions, selfish actions, fearful actions, a life without any true, strong meaning in it. And some people go pretty quick, and others may live a much longer life. It isn't the only reason souls keep people alive, but it certainly has a lot to do with it. And if you haven't thought about that before, this is the time to think about it. Okay, so when we get into a person's 60s, they're into the second go-around in life. The second go-around in life, at this time in the development of humanity, usually ends with the life ending soon after the second round. Second round is another 49 years, so it goes to 98 years old, 99. Very few people make it to 100. Like less than 10% of the population. So you get into this question then, how come there's a third 49 years and what happened to that, you know? Well, the third 49 years is supposed to be the age of wisdom, where you become a teacher in everything you've experienced in life to all the people your age and younger, and anyone who's older who's still somewhat illusion as well in the areas that you're not, and vice versa. So there's a totally different element. We'll get to that. Within this second round, what you're doing is you're attempting to put into action, not teaching, but into action, a element that is now based upon highly creative elements that is not like the rest of the population in today's modern world. So in other words, I'm saying you're going the opposite direction the way most people go. Most people go in lacking creativity. They restrict the element of action with high levels of creation. And they become, you know, like in the rocking chair on the porch or something. They're not going many people say, well, the most creative years in the person's life is before 35 years of age. Well, that's because this whole thing is upside down. It's not supposed to be that way. That goes against what life is supposed to be about for human beings. When you go against that, you're going against God's plan. And guess what that means? You're dying. You're going faster and faster towards death. If you do this plan that I'm suggesting, and you become more creative, not less, as you move into your 50s and 60s and beyond, your life will become much longer on average, and you will have no fear of death, none. You will help many other people to gain the same perspective, hopefully earlier in their life than you did. And by the time you're in the time when most people are preparing to physically die, you may be preparing to physically live a considerably longer time than seems even possible, past the age of 100. But not past the age of 100 in a nursing home where you forget your own name sometimes, but living past 100 in some way that seems impossible in today's understanding, but at times before, in prehistory, before we have historical knowledge of it, we have spiritual knowledge of it, people lived in the 120s and 130s up to 147 years. And he goes, oh, that's just junk they threw in the Bible, isn't it? It's all a bunch of nonsense. And, no, that stuff came from myths that were mythologies of real events that took place thousands and thousands, tens of thousands of years before any Bibles or any that we are familiar with today. So it is definitely possible to do this. Now you could say, well, does that mean I shouldn't be afraid of death because I'm going to live a lot longer? No. You shouldn't be afraid of death because as you live a lot longer and you are more and more creative, it means nothing to you. It's totally irrelevant. It doesn't matter because you're creating at the most you can of virtue, of light in this world, and helping others to do the same. Now, you could say, well, why is it slowed down then? What stops then after 98 to 100 years old? Well, it doesn't stop. It's just that the next stage, the third stage, which most people do not experience in today's world, but it was experienced like in the golden age of Atlantis and other times, even in Lemuria was experienced, which is way before we can imagine time-wise. But the point is that the most benefits you can give to others, because the body still does decline to some extent, is through teaching rather than to be as active. So you're creative, but you're creative in your teaching from, oh, say, 100 years on of age, until your body is no longer useful for even that purpose. And then you consciously choose to leave. If you can get to that third stage, you will leave through conscious thought. You won't even die subconsciously or unconsciously. You just leave consciously. Somewhat like some of the Tibetan Buddhists have explained in other ways, you might even choose the chakras you're going to live through and how and where you're going to go and when in the next dimension and what you're going to do fully when you get there. You've spent years planning your next life there. There's no surprise about it. There's not even an inkling of fear about it. None. That's the kind of preparing spiritually for death I'm talking about tonight. That's if you started, if we could go back and start with the kids that I talked about the earlier part of the show, and start preparing them for this whole thing, right from them, and then continue on in every way, in every point that we discussed, developing ourselves in the most spiritual way possible, our lives and take a totally different perspective, a totally different meaning while we're physically alive. That meaning can go on forever. It's not going to slow down. It's not going to stop. It takes different perspectives. Obviously, in the astral world, you're going to live differently than here because the physics change. Same thing with the monastic element. But in the mental world, it's a different life there, too. But if you prepared yourself, you're dealing very little with Akashic issues, very little with egotism and arrogance, and almost exclusively with serving as a soul. What a life that is. Death is not even the slightest of a thought. Death is like changing clothes. You might find changing clothes more difficult than death. If you listen to what I'm saying and you live your life in the ways that I'm suggesting. Okay, let's go back again. I wanted to make sure I covered that little part there so I didn't run out of time. Let's go back a little bit and talk about what the second stage is, where a person is being most creative in their life ever while they're 60, 70, 80, 90 years old. Totally the opposite of what our model is today, right? Well, I'm going to go retire. Oh, I got all this time and nothing to do. And, oh, well. Who in the heck wants to live their life that way? I don't know. I guess some people do, yeah, because they're too afraid to believe anything else. But it's nonsense. It's total nonsense. That doesn't mean you can't go on a vacation to a new place and look at it and enjoy that or something. That's all right. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about being the most creative you've ever been in whatever you do. And do it in a way that helps others to do the same. You're going to help others to be co-creative of virtue, of light in form like you are doing. You will help them to become part of this new existence that you're enjoying so amazing. So the greatest years are from when? 57 on. If you look at it from that standpoint, I mean, if the totality of issues. The first, you know, after the first 49 years, it usually takes a person about 7 years to figure out all the ways that they're going to need to be much more creative in their life and to go about doing some of those ways. It takes that much time, actually, to, if you're going to do this thing right, you have to figure this whole thing out and then get over all the fears you have of death, because that gets rid of almost all your fears in life. And so you can do anything, you put your mind to it and your heart to it, and make sure that the light of God is within you as you do it. So this is a tremendously exciting time. This is a tremendously meaningful time for those who understand what I'm saying. If you are finding that your life is the opposite of what I'm telling you, call me. I'll talk to you about it. Or email me, but I don't really have discussions by email. All I'll do is get you to talk to me. So, but you can do either. And the point is that this should be what's happening. And you say, well, what about all these diseases and Alzheimer's? And what if I lost my mind? All those things can be taken care of by doing the things I'm suggesting. There's no such thing as disease that doesn't have first within you wrong motive of life, wrong thoughts, wrong actions that are against our co-creator, God. And no creation or limited creation. All those things produce disease. Want to know why you're sick? Look at that. That's why you're sick. Could there be some karmic issues? Usually, but most of the karmic issues are gone by age 56. After the first round of life, which is 49 years, the last 7 years, usually you get some accelerated karma in, and you get rid of a lot of karma. So you can't, you know, if you're in your mid-60s, oh, I'm having a karmic crisis because of everything I did 5 lifetimes ago, that's probably not true. Could you? I mean, yeah, it's possible. most likely isn't true. Most people think they're sick because of the karma. No. They're sick because of the fear to live, the fear to be a co-creator with God, with others. That's what causes them to be sick. That's what causes them to age. You want to change that? You can. You have the ability to do so. Okay, let me finish by, I got less than 5 minutes here. Okay, let me finish by going over the last part of what life could be like, which again is past 99, 100 years. And I know for most of you, you're going to think this is just crazy, even bothering to talk about it. You'll all be dead by then. No, you won't if you choose to do the things I'm saying. I'm not saying you're going to live forever. As a matter of fact, just the opposite. I'm guaranteeing you're going to die. It's just a question of how you want to live. If you've gotten rid of all your fear from approximately age 56 on, you have a good chance of going well past 100. And when you get to those hundred-year-plus times, you need to have prepared and be preparing to become a great teacher. Now, a great teacher is not someone who knows everything, understands everything. A great teacher is someone who has wisdom. What is wisdom? Wisdom is the ability to apply through consciousness knowledge in ways that helps others to do the same in almost any walk or area of life, almost any condition, almost any circumstance. That's what wisdom is. And those that are wise in this third part of life, that goes up to all the way up to age 47, possibly. And don't expect you will live to 47. Probably just another 20 or 30 years, because to get to 47, you have to have lived your life almost perfectly from day one. We're not going to do that. Most of us are not in that ballpark. Okay, but let's say you get another 20 years of teaching, or 30. It's hard to imagine, isn't it? But you could still be as you might have been at 70 in modern society at that age. So it isn't like you're going to be some kind of freak who looks like they're a skeleton or, you know, some other weird kind of apparition. That's not what's going to happen. The aging process does not continue to accelerate in those people who live creatively and then wisely. Those who live life with great wisdom die from life with great joy and bliss. And that's where you're headed for. The last couple years of your life will be the most joyful years, the most blissful years you've had at any time, growing from age 100 on in an amazing array of time. So from 98, if you went all the way to 47, you would be continuing become more joyful, to become more of all the wonderful things that you would seek to have in your life. They will happen. They can happen to you in this third part of existence that we don't even think about today, because most people think that we'll be dead or dying by the shift in time and the shift from a creative life to a wise and teaching life. Now, what if you're doing teaching now? Well, in theory, what you want in your next life is to be able to join all these things together and do them all at once. But that's a whole other show, and I'm running out of time. Not time in life, but time in radio. So, I have to tell you, I hope this has been a bit of an eye-opener. I hope that preparing spiritually for death was not what you thought it was going to be. And until next week, this has been Niles McFlower for Why Life Is.